Welcome to Geopolitical Horizon, the podcast from geopolity.com. Geopolity will soon be publishing its annual report, Strategic Estimate 2025. Our analysts have worked hard following the key events in the past year, pursuing trends and patterns in order to give you their analysis and insight. I've had the privilege of getting a preview of the report, and I have Geopolity founder Adnan Khan here with me today to discuss this report. How are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm very well, Yusuf. How are you doing?
Yeah, I love Strategic Estimate. I think I've been following it since you started it. I think it's very useful. It gives a good insight over the full year. And there's a lot that's happened this year. To start off, what is the main theme of the report this year?
So Yusuf, until probably a week, 2 weeks ago, the main theme was going to be the re-election of Donald Trump. We were going to go into a bit of a deep dive of what's coming up for America, where America is, what you can expect. But the events of the last couple of weeks in Palestine and Syria specifically, I think we've decided to change the main theme. And this is just how geopolitics is. You can have nothing happen for a while, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, things happen. So yes, the main theme will be Palestine and specifically Syria. And obviously, lots happened. I think when we spoke this time last year, we were, 3 months into what was going on in Gaza. Now it's spread to Lebanon, it's spread to Iraq, it's spread to Syria, it's spread all the way to Iran and Yemen. So this has the impact. It's such an impactful event. It's going to impact all sorts of different issues. So yes, what's going on in Palestine and specifically Syria, that will be the main theme this year.
Obviously, the US is now involved in technically two wars, one in Ukraine. Yeah, not directly, but still involved, one in Ukraine and now in the Middle East. What's the latest with these? Is there any link between them?
So yes, interesting term you use, they're indirectly involved. That is what the global superpower does now. It can't get involved in every war. So what it does, it backs a side, it arms them, it trains them, it gives them intelligence. This is the role America plays. And you've seen this in both the Middle East and Ukraine now. So specifically Ukraine, Yusuf, we are 2 months away from the 3-year anniversary of the Ukraine war. It was that long ago. Russia invaded, had that really bad start to the war, the free front, and it struggled to conquer the capital. Today, the situation is completely the opposite. Russia's back on top. There's question marks about the support of the West for Ukraine. In fact, all the talk now about the Ukraine war is for negotiations to begin, a ceasefire to lead to some sort of permanent settlement. It's like no one really has the appetite for war now in Ukraine. We've gone from as long as it takes to let's get on with it now and let's finalize it. So this year, really, there's been a lot more obstacles in funding Ukraine. All of these are self-imposed. A lot of people just feel this has gone on for a long time and they can't see Ukraine winning, especially Russia taking over more and more territory. So there's a lot more talk now of bringing the war to an end through some sort of negotiation. Trump has said that it was a silly war. America shouldn't have got involved. And famously, Trump has said that he would end the war in 24 hours. And in about, 2 or 3 weeks, he'll have the chance to prove if he can do it. The situation in the Middle East is very different. We spoke this time last year of the brutal beginning of a war. You obviously had the Hamas operation in occupied Palestine or Israel. And then you had the Israeli response. And really, it's got worse since then. Israel is now at the international court, being accused of committing a genocide. In Gaza, they have effectively succeeded in committing a genocide. Literally, there's nowhere for people to live. Israel then opened up a front in Lebanon in the north, and that's still going on. Hezbollah has been completely decimated. Israel then took the war further into Syria now, and it took the war into Iran itself. There's been 2 rounds of attacks between both countries. So the Middle East war, the side America's backed, which is Israel, they are on top. They are committing a genocide with complete global cover. And what's happened is Syria now has really served Israel's agenda. Israel is fully taking advantage of it. In Ukraine, things have turned out a bit differently. If we say the aim of America is not necessarily for Ukraine to win, but for Ukraine not to lose, then America's achieved its objective. But if the aim is to make Russia lose, if the aim is to weaken Russia, well, that actually hasn't happened. If anything, Russia's actually on top now. And the fact that the West are talking about negotiating with them shows you really where things are.
What's interesting about the fall of the Assad regime? I know we did a podcast last week and I'm sure our viewers have listened to it. First of all, we'll go into what it means for the US and the broader region. But I was just reading today that Israel has already planned settlements in the Golan Heights, which is just recently occupied. So Israel, it seems like it's constantly doing this land grab. What do you make of it?
Yeah, so Israel's been very open, in fact, throughout its history, about taking more land under the guise of security. And this is like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for them. They've decimated all the proxy groups that were established to fight Israel have been decimated. Look at Hezbollah, look at Hamas. And now the fact that the regime in Syria has fallen, and from through Syria went the supply line from Iran, through Iraq, through Syria to Lebanon. So Israel really is achieving a lot of its long-held dreams. And for America, there's a more broad objective here. If America wants to focus on the Far East because China's the problem, then you need a stable Middle East. And I don't mean stable as in peaceful. You need a setup where nothing can kick off. So effectively, after the last two decades of working with Iran, and what I mean here is when America was bleeding to death in Iraq, when it was bleeding to death in Afghanistan, it turned to Iran. And Iran came in, and Iran ends the insurgency, and Iranian proxies dominate the political system there. So effectively, they saved America. Now, America now needs to move on, and these proxy groups could potentially be a problem. So what you find this year, in fact, the last few weeks, the proxy groups that Iran's been using, all of them have been decimated. And that's why now Iran is quite openly saying we need to focus more on domestic issues. They're effectively saying we've listened and we've heard. So they're going back behind their borders. And any proxy group that doesn't play ball, America will smash them like they did to the militia groups in Iraq who wanted to come and save Bashar al-Assad. And even Bashar al-Assad, Israel has been very open that their most secure border is the Syrian border. So really, Syria's foreign policy, despite all the rhetoric, it actually supported Israel. And now that this regime's gone, Israel is making sure whoever comes in, they would have no military that could threaten Israel. That's why they, like they said, they've taken out 80% of their military capabilities. And the new regime that's come in, it is in no position to take on Israel. So for Israel, it's actually got some very unique realities where it's taking full advantage. I mean, they never dreamed that they'll get this chance. So from an American perspective, this region, Israel will be secure. The leaders in the region will do the Abraham Accords. And then the leaders of these countries, their job is to control their population. If they do that, America can then focus on the Far East and not worry about the Middle East. If that unravels, then America has a very, very big problem. So as far as America's concerned, when they look at the Middle East, it's a tick. It's where they want it to be. A lot of it could potentially unravel. As far as they're concerned, as we come to the end of 2024, the Middle East is where they would like it to be.
So with the fall of the Assad regime, what does it actually mean for US interests and obviously the broader region?
So for US interests, it's more about having stability and dealing with the tension in the area. So the tension is really Israel and the fact that Iran, I mean, the Israelis call it, it's the head of the octopus. Their parts go into Lebanon, goes into Syria, goes into Iraq. So if Israel feels Iran's not a threat, then Israel doesn't need to launch a war, launch attacks. So that's the degree of stability America needs. So effectively, what America's done, it's done a U-turn in the last 20 years, where Iran was the stabilizer. Iran's now been completely weakened and its wings have been cut. Israel's now the stabilizer in the region. This is what Israel's always wanted. We will work with you, Americans. We are your aircraft carrier in the region. So for America, in the broader context, Yusuf, a stable Middle East means they can focus elsewhere.
In the report, there's a section on the USA, and it's very interesting on how you actually pitched it. It's pitched as if the USA is the new USSR. That's a very, very interesting way to put things. Do you feel like the USA is on decline like the USSR?
So yes, we picked that title because America's being compared to the USSR and the Roman Empire, because America seems to have problems which are very similar to what these two empires had as well. Now, the USSR is probably a bit closer to us in history compared to the Roman Empire, and I'm sure many of our listeners were probably around when the Soviet Union was around. But at the end, really, the 1980s, you find the Soviet Union suffered from so many issues. It was in debt. Its military was bloated. There was uprisings going on across the Union. Is the Red Army going to come in now to come and put it down? And they had just finished a war in Afghanistan, which was a complete disaster. Now, all the things I've just mentioned there, Yusuf, America's suffering from the same problems. America's got debt that's out of control. America's military has been defeated in Iraq and Afghanistan, and there's question marks. Can they really take on China? So America's hammer, there's question marks over it. And the people questioning America's military the most are the American people themselves. And it doesn't help when people like Donald Trump say we shouldn't even be involved in these forever wars. On the other side, you find these internal tensions now in America, which is exactly what happened in the Soviet Union. the Soviet Republic, they all started to rise up. So when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, everybody was expecting the Soviet Union to send in the Red Army. They'd done that previously in Hungary and Czechoslovakia. When the Soviets decided not to do that, what it showed people is that Moscow can no longer defend or is no longer willing to stop an uprising. So what that told everyone is the Soviet Union is a spent force. And in America, with the run-up to the elections, you saw a lot of tensions regarding the election. If the result doesn't go in Trump's favor, will he accept it or not? So there's a lot of internal division. So when you look at all the factors that emerged at the end of the Soviet Union, you're seeing all of them there in America. So what we do in this section, Yusuf, is we look at some of the key challenges the Soviet Union faced and how America also faces the same as well. We also have a look at some of the differences, but really, it's very uncanny of how many similarities there are between both powers. Both countries went into Afghanistan thinking they're very powerful and it will give their empire more strength. Both of them lost. And the Soviet Union left Afghanistan in 1987. And within a few years, the Soviet Union collapsed. America left in 2021. Let's see if it's going to end up the same way the Soviet Union did.
We were always going to get onto Trump. Trump, I saw the initial cover that you'd planned with Trump on the front page. There's a section on there, Trump 2.0. Ever since he won the election in November, he's already been getting plenty of headlines. How do you think he's going to do in his second term?
So yes, Yusuf, you saw the cover. Yes, I think we will be changing the cover now because the theme has changed. And that's just how politics and geopolitics is. Things change literally overnight. So this is quite unique. Trump's first term was quite unique. His statements, his policies, and we're seeing the same again. What's interesting this time around, Trump is a lot more experienced. He understands the machinery of American politics. So the tensions are already boiling over. But previously, because Trump didn't really know anybody, he generally picked mainstream established people to be in his cabinet, to be the implementers of his policy program. This time around, what he's doing is he's actually picking people he knows, and some of these are very, very unconventional candidates. So already he's having problems with some of these. So his defense secretary is already running into problems. Tulsi Gabbard, who's supposed to be the national intelligence head, she's already running into trouble. So what you're seeing is already tensions are boiling over. Trump is already putting out there what he plans to do in terms of key policies. He wants to continue to take on China. He wants to end these wars, which is going to lead to some sort of conflict with the deep state. The main thing we talk about in this section, and probably what we need to look at going forward, is the Heritage Foundation. They wrote his transition program, and their plan is to really change the internal dynamics of the American political system. They want to reduce the powers of the federal state, and they want power to be more and more centralized into the White House. So really what you have is you have the White House and every other aspect of the government they just implement. They have no say in policy. And Trump has an old agenda. He has his view about how much America should be involved in the world. He has his view towards Vladimir Putin. He has his view towards the Middle East. He has his view towards LGBTQ. He has his views towards energy. He wants more fossil fuel use rather than going green. So he's already put his cards on the table, and he wasn't supposed to be here, Yusuf. The Republicans did everything they could to stop him from winning. But what they realized in the end, that he's so popular that if they don't back him, the Republicans are going to have a bigger problem. So the Republican Party doesn't exist now. The Republican Party is the Donald Trump Party. So that's why they believe by working with Trump, we should be able to influence him. And Trump has a lot of foreign policy positions, but more importantly, he wants to change the dynamics internally of the focus of American direction is going. And that would lead to some sort of clash with the deep state. We're seeing it already with his appointment. So that's something definitely we're going to be watching. But in this section, what we do is we have a look at the challenges Trump faced coming to power and what he said he plans to do. And, you know, we're only a couple of weeks away now before he comes in. But definitely, I think the Trump's re-election was going to be the theme of the report this year, purely because of whoever the leader of the superpower is affects the world. So definitely that's something we're going to be watching going forward this 2025.
I'm sure there'll be a lot more podcasts that we do on Trump. Moving on, this section is something that unfortunately is been forgotten, but it's actually a major part of US policy. It's the battle between US and China. Where does this stand currently? Can you give us a quick update?
So yes, Donald Trump started the trade war with China when he was in power, 2016 to 19. He began the trade war, which involved lots of tariffs on lots of goods. What Joe Biden did when he came in, he continued with that and expanded. He's now expanded, he's banned advanced semiconductor exports to China. He's banned even the machines that can make semiconductors to China. He's now put loads of tariffs on high-tech products so China can't get hold of them. So what's really happened under the Biden term, he has expanded and deepened the sanctions and the restrictions on Chinese access to technology from America. Even though America doesn't make the deep ultraviolet and extreme ultraviolet machines that make advanced semiconductors, America has banned the Dutch company that makes them from even selling them to China. So for the last 4 years, what we've seen is tariffs and more tariffs. And some of the tariffs are going to be 100%. And they kick in on the 1st of January. So the battle between America and China is deepening. The economic battle is in fifth gear. It's full swing. And really what we're likely to see under Trump is this expanding to other areas as well. So what we're definitely going to be watching in 2025 and the rest of Trump's term is how he tries to deal with China, because there are many areas where China has a lot of capability and it can actually stand up against America as well. So really, America's doubling down. I mean, China for America, China's the new Soviet Union. It's the foe, it's the menace, it's the competitor, it's the country that creates instability in the world because it's challenging America. So for America, it's all hands on deck now when it comes to China.
Let's look at another power. If we look at Russia, you said earlier on, it's going to be the third year anniversary in a month's time in Ukraine. What's the status of this battle? What's the status of this war? Do we see an end approaching?
So I think Russia could not be in a more perfect situation. It's reversed its bad start. It's expanded its territorial holdings. Ukraine tried to do a counterattack in 2023. That was a failure. In 2024, they managed to go into Russia mainland in Kursk, but they're struggling to even hold it. Russia has thrown soldiers. It's got drones from Iran. It's got artillery from North Korea. And its economy is still standing. It's stable at the moment. So really, the West has lost the appetite for continuing this war. They can't see how Ukraine is going to win. In fact, what America's saying to Ukraine now is, we've just given you $20 billion. This is from the money Russia has in European and Western banks. Here you go. Here's some money. Here's some arms. Now it's over to you. You got to do the rest. There's nothing more we can give you. You got to now defeat Russia. And if you can't defeat Russia, then we need to start talking. And the problem is, whatever talks happen, Yusuf, Russia has the upper hand. Why does Russia need to talk? Why does Russia need to compromise when Russia has taken 20% of Ukrainian territory? So the situation couldn't be more perfect for Russia. Now, if this war was to go on for another 2 years, then Russia would be in a problem, because that would mean your troops need to be fed. They're probably dying. It's affecting your broader economy. So year one was very bad for Russia. Year three has been very bad for Ukraine. And people can see the end of the war, but not the way they want to. They want to see a Ukrainian victory. What you're really seeing is potentially a Russian victory, or a victory where Ukraine will have to accept it's lost 20% of its country.
Last June, it was the one-year anniversary of the Wagner attempted rebellion. What's happened to them since? I know Russia almost disbanded them and then brought some of them into the main army. Have they completely disappeared now?
It was back in June where the Wagner head, Prigozhin, he did that rebellion, stroke coup, whatever you want to call it. And that was building because the Wagner head was having a lot of tension with the defense secretary and the head of the army. What Wagner did is, in areas of Ukraine they were fighting, they were taking credit. And actually, they did quite well compared to the Russian army. But that's because the Wagner is like a crack force. Their job is to go in into a small area and do something. The Russian army has got nearly 800-mile front that it has to defend. So they're not really fighting the same wars, although they're on the same battlefield. So what's happened is quite interesting. For about a month, nothing much happened. Everybody's waiting for Putin to do something. There was an African conference where Prigozhin was invited to. But then what happened was, when his plane was returning from somewhere, it crashed and he passed away. Surprise, surprise. And what's happened since then is Wagner has been amalgamated into the National Army. So what you find is they're still present in Syria. They're still present in Africa, but they've been amalgamated into the broader army. So their leadership now, their management is all under the normal army, the National Army. So Wagner still exists, but its activities, logistics have now been brought into the Russian army effectively. So in the end, looking back now, Yusuf, it wasn't that big of a challenge to Putin. I think at the time, a lot of people thought this is it. They're coming from within. In the end, it's not really had an impact. It's not impacted the war, neither has it impacted Putin's position. So this rebellion, Putin's managed to, wave it off. He's managed to see it by, and now they're looking much more stronger in the Ukraine war.
There's a section on the demographics of Russia and how this could potentially be another problem that Putin and his administration face. Could you give us a little bit of insight into that? Where do things stand currently?
Yes, demographics has been a problem for a while. The collapse of the Soviet Union led to massive social issues. And because of the collapse, the collapse in the Soviet Union was worse than the Great Depression. So the 1990s was the worst time. So that led to a collapse in birth rate. It led to a collapse in the length of people's lives. And this has had a big impact on Russia. So Russia's population has been in decline for a little while. And what you're seeing is the minorities and Muslims are making up more and more of the Russian population. So since Putin's come to power, he's been trying to address this. What they've been trying to do is give incentives to have kids. They've been reducing taxes and giving subsidies to people who want to have children. But what's happened is none of these policies have succeeded. So what we do in this section of the report, Yusuf, we have a look at what Russia plans to do. And what Russia has done is realized what we've tried to do to reverse the declining population is not working. So what that now means is Russia would have to get involved in a more granular level. It's going to have to get involved in families at a more local level to make this work. And that raises all sorts of issues because you're at war. Russia's economy has got challenges. It's been cut off from the global economy. So we have a look of all of that. You know, in many ways, Yusuf, Russia may say our biggest threat is the West, but the threat also is a declining population as well. If your population is declining, there's less people working, less people paying tax, less money going to the government, and revenues are very important at the moment considering you're in the middle of a war at the moment. So yes, in this section, we have a good look at where the demographic situation is and really some of the policies Russia potentially is looking at in order to reverse this.
I feel like at this point about a declining population because of a reduced birth rate, it's something that's happening across a lot of the world, especially in like the West.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, the third world is criticized for being overpopulated. Whilst the Western world, they are seeing population decline. They are trying to plug that with immigration. So Germany and Japan are at the forefront. The other Western countries aren't far behind. And fertility rates around the world have actually fallen. Even in countries which are known to have a lot of children, what you find is the rate of children is actually falling. Although it's not falling to the level where its population decline, it is falling. Even China, Yusuf, now China's rate of growth has gone negative in terms of population. This country that had a ballooning population, they're now going the other way. So this raises loads of challenges. So this is a global problem, really. And if you look at the last decade or so, everything in the West has promoted people having children is bad. Having children is bad for the economy. And now you're hearing having children is bad for the environment. So this has a knock-on effect. There's consequences. You don't have children. How do you replace people who leave the labor force? How do you replace people who retire? Where's the safety net? You can't just rely on the state. And if your population is declining, it means the state would have to get more and more involved and give more and more funding to look after people as well. So some countries think robotics would be a solution to this. You automate the production process. But at the end of the day, if people aren't having children, this has massive social issues. And we're seeing that in Europe at the moment where people are very critical of immigrants. But you need immigration because the white Caucasian population just isn't having children. So this is a major geopolitical issue, demographic.
I can imagine that there will be a shift in perspective on immigration. If we move on to China, you always think about China being an economic powerhouse, but it is actually facing problems economically. Could you go into a bit more detail about that?
Yeah, so in the China section, Yusuf, we have a look at China's economic model. This is the problem they're facing at the moment. Since China's rise, since the early 2000s, they've relied on a very simple model, which is China has an unlimited supply of workers, the cheapest in the world, so they can make the goods the cheapest than anywhere else in the world. So China buys raw materials from around the world, it buys energy, it then converts them using its labor force to final goods. These goods are then put on ships and exported to the rest of the world. Now, this model worked until the 2008 economic crisis, where there was recessions and double recessions, actually, in the West. So their consumption went down drastically. And because China relied on goods to this market, it had a big, big impact on China. So what the regime did is they intervened by stimulating the economy, by printing money. And a lot of that money ended up in real estate. And that's why today you have many towns in China that are ghost towns. No one's living there, but the building and construction of whole towns was used to keep the economy going. Now, China realized they couldn't do that endlessly. So since then, they've been having a look, let's shift our economy. We need to go to another model. And this is what we have a look at chapter, what the options are. And they've got a few options.
You would think, Yusuf, with a population of 1.4 billion, if the domestic population consume what they produce, then that would be a good economic model. It's a domestic consumption model, which is what we see in America. But this has got a lot of challenges. Most Chinese didn't see the benefits of the last two decades.
Most Chinese actually are just above the poverty line. Although overall China has improved a lot, it has a bigger economy. A lot of that wealth is concentrated in a very small segment of the population. So what we do in this chapter, we have a look at some of the policy China's trying to pursue. So China's trying to go high tech. It's trying to move up the technology ladder. China wants to become a leader in the next generation of new technologies and be a major exporter of those. And already you're seeing subsidies and tariffs are going up in Europe when it comes to motor vehicles, things like that. So China's economic model is actually turning into a very, very big issue. And you don't change your economic model overnight, Yusuf. This takes the best part of a decade. And it's been over a decade since Xi Jinping came into power. And this is something he's not been able to resolve. So in this chapter, we have a look at the options they've got and the implications.
In the report, you discuss two key Chinese projects, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor and Made in China 2025. How both these projects fared so far?
Yes, Yusuf, these are interestingly both projects coming up to their anniversaries this year, and it's really two different tales. The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor was a very important project. It was part of the Belt and Road Initiative, and the whole idea was it would link the west of China with Pakistan. And then through Pakistan, it would give them access to the Arabian Sea. So it would circumvent the sea lines of communication that go through Malaysia, Indonesia, which potentially America can interject. And what's happened over the last decade, Yusuf, is lots of grand promises and very little delivery from Pakistan. So initially, Pakistan agreed to many things. And what China has found is that firstly, the Balochistan region, which is the coastal, which had the region with the coast, which has access to the sea, there's actually been a small-scale insurgency going on across Chinese workers. And that's because the Balochis aren't happy that they're getting nothing out of this project. China sent their own companies to go and do all the work, which a lot of local workers were very, very unhappy about. The Chinese even accused Pakistan of not providing sufficient security to Chinese workers. So quite a few Chinese workers were kidnapped and actually killed. And actually what you find is the CPEC is nowhere near the scale and the breadth it was supposed to be at what was promised. So that's actually not looking very good, that particular project. I think it's too big to fail. China can't abandon it. However, how much China will get out of CPEC is debatable. I think they're going to have to scale it down, but it's just not doable. And a lot of the problems are from Pakistan's side as well. Pakistan are agreeing to things, then they're having to reverse that. And China's just finding that, I find something very interesting, Yusuf. When China agreed to CPEC, it didn't carry out an assessment of Pakistan, didn't look at Pakistan. It didn't send its officials to go and assess, is it even feasible? What's happened is China agreed to this project, and then it went and sent people to go and look at the feasibility. And then it would be embarrassing if they did a U-turn. So the CPEC is absolutely, after a decade, not looking good at all. In 2025, on the other hand, it's the anniversary or supposed to be the end of the project Made in China 2025. So in 2015, China realized that it's manufacturing largely low-end products, textiles, electronics. And what China realizes, it needs to go up the technological ladder if it wants to compete with these other countries. So what China did in this project, it identified a host of next generation technologies. And what it said is the manufacturing of these, by 2020, we should be doing around 25% of them domestically. And by 2025, we should be 75% of the production of these should be from Chinese companies, and we should be self-sufficient. And China, Yusuf, has already met these goals even before the deadline is due. So you find when it comes to electric batteries, when it comes to automobiles, when it comes to green technologies, China, with a few years in advance, has managed to achieve those objectives. In 90% of the targets it had, it's already achieved them or even exceeded them. There's a couple of areas where they're behind, but it's not a problem because they just haven't achieved the target, but they're not actually that far behind. And what you find, Yusuf, on the technology side, China is doing very, very well. China is actually a leader and it's leading on the next generation of technologies. Now, some of these haven't become mainstream technologies yet, and some of these are in the research stage only. But nevertheless, China, when it comes to Made in China 2025, they've hit sixes. When it comes to CPEC, they've been stumped.
The two regions China is currently getting a lot of tension is in Africa and the Middle East. Is China now a new power that's competing with the likes of America and Russia in these areas?
That's what China would like everybody to believe. China feels that it should be respected as a power and our country should recognize it as such. So in Africa, China has been very, very active for a number of years. But what you find, Yusuf, when we do this in the report, we have a look at what China's specifically doing on the ground. And what you find, Yusuf, there's a lot of construction, there's a lot of infrastructure, there's a lot of economics, but we really don't see any politics. We don't see China get involved in regional issues, tension between countries at all. It seems still that China views Africa as a place it can import resources, materials, commodities, energy that it needs for its industrial machine. So although China has very good relationships in Africa, beyond economics, there isn't really much going on. And that's why in Africa, China and America don't clash much because America does the politics and the security and China just does the economics. So that's Africa. When you look at the Middle East, what you find is a lot of noise from the Middle East. China's a new power. China's got this strategic deal with Iran. China is now Saudi Arabia's largest importer of oil. China's now a new power. But what you find, Yusuf, again, on Palestine, Israel, what's the Chinese position? It's no different to the Americans. On Iran, Saudi tensions, what's the Chinese position? Nothing really. So you find, again, Yusuf, what the Middle East should look like. China now trying to work with the regional leaders to bring that policy into reality. There isn't one. They don't really have a policy. What they seem to do is we want the oil and we want to be perceived to be involved, but we're physically not. So we go through quite a bit of detail looking at Chinese action in both Africa and the Middle East. And then we conclude that really beyond economics, there isn't really much coming on. China is not challenging America in these regions. China is not countering America's strategies. China does economics and America does politics.
The final area I want to discuss with you from the report is the area of Europe. We touched on it earlier about the Ukraine war. How does the Ukraine war look from the perspective of Europe?
So Europe has completely gone the other way now. In 2022, when Russia invaded, the continent's at war, Russia's expanding. However long it takes, we have to back the Ukrainians. We take the Ukrainians in as refugees. Now it's gone completely the other way. People have had enough. It's gone on for too long. We're spending too much money on it. And more importantly, you said people just can't see how Ukraine is going to win. They can't see how Ukraine is going to defeat Russia. So they're saying that if this goes on for another 20 years, the outcome is going to be the same. So rather than the West having to pour money into Ukraine, what everyone's saying is we've got other priorities. Ukraine should just negotiate and come to some sort of agreement. In fact, across Europe, Yusuf, Germany, Austria, the UK, France, really everyone's turned against the war now. They want the war to come to an end. The war's had an impact on the European economies. So really today, the Europeans are in a completely opposite position to where they were 2.5-3 years ago.
One of the things that Europe wanted to do very early on in the war was they wanted to wean itself from the dependency of energy from Russia. Has it actually managed to do that 3 years on?
So the Europeans were importing, I think, Yusuf, around 170,000 cubic meters of gas. That went down to under 20 billion cubic meters. So that's a drastic drop that happened. But what we're finding, Yusuf, in the last year is Europe's imports of Russian energy has started to increase. It's nowhere near the level it was prior to the war. And the reason why this is the energy Russia supplied, the volume, the pipes, the logistics, no one else can do that. These pipelines go back to the Soviet Union. They've been around for a long time. And these are coming from the Siberian fields. And so the volumes they're coming at, nobody else can actually replace that. So what Europe's had to do is had to go to multiple places now to get the same volume of oil and gas. So you find that they're having to go to Algeria, they're having to go to the Caucasus. The main source of energy at the moment is they're getting American liquefied natural gas, which has a much higher price. And that's not sustainable going forward. They're going to have to really think of another way. But again, Yusuf, I would say there was never a short-term solution to this because Russia's there on the European continent, because the infrastructure's there, none of that can be replaced overnight. It's going to take time. So there's going to be pain in the meantime. So that's why you find in Germany, it's caused a lot of tension and issues in the country. Things are very expensive. It's having an effect on the economy, has an effect on the currency. You're seeing some Eastern European countries are still importing from Russia, although it's in very small volume. So yes, you could argue Europe has stopped or reduced drastically the energy is getting from Russia. However, it's causing a whole host of other issues. So yes, it's weaned itself off it, but the alternative, there's serious question marks over how sustainable it is.
Obviously, one of those countries is Germany, the European giant. It does seem like Germany is now on the ropes. What do you make of that?
Yes, so Germany is going through quite a difficult period. So its government has collapsed, the minority government. This week, by the time this podcast goes out, the vote of no confidence would have happened over Olaf Scholz. It is looking extremely unlikely he's going to win that. So that means that the Germans would have to go to a national election, and their national elections were due this year in June anyway, just having to do it earlier. What's happening, Yusuf, is Germany, the strategic country, the guarantor of Europe, it's got loads of problems from some policy decisions it's made. So for a long time, Yusuf, Germany, its policies were based on two pillars. Security is from America and energy is from Russia. And what's happened is when Russia invaded Ukraine, they had to make a decision. Whose side are you on? Are you America or are you Russia? You couldn't be in bed with both of them now. So they chose we're going to go with America. So that means is it was an action of economic suicide, what they did. So they were so dependent upon Russian energy, they had no alternative in place. They cut that relationship and now they're having to deal with the repercussions of it. So what's happened is the economic situation is so bad in terms of the currency and inflation. The first thing that's happened is the government's falling apart. The next thing that's happened, Yusuf, is China now is producing electric batteries and is producing electric vehicles. German brands like Volkswagen, Mercedes, BMW have dominated the automobile market. And China now has developed the next generation of vehicles, the fully battery-powered vehicles. The Germans just can't compete with it. China has a 1.4 billion internal market. Germany wants access to that market, which China's restricting. So now there's a lot more talk now of restricting the European market, restricting Chinese access. So Germany has a big problem. I think about 10% of the economy is on cars, and China has now become a dominant car producer in the world, which the Germans just physically can't compete with. China is making cheaper vehicles and is making electric vehicles with long-lasting batteries. So the key industry, the automobile industry in Germany, that's being affected by this. And thirdly, Yusuf, the biggest problem Germany's got is demographics. Its population in decline. So population is in decline. Its politics is broken. The green focus of the economy has completely been smashed. And now China's actually emerging as well. So Germany is on the ropes, absolutely. It's got big, big, significant issues to deal with. And these have been building for a while, really.
In the global economy section of the report, there is two topics that I found very interesting. One is the Western bloc versus the Eastern bloc. And the second topic was, where does money come from? Could you just give us a little bit of a taster of that just for the audience to hear?
So yes, all the talk of BRICS, we thought it would be a good chance now. BRICS has been around nearly 15 years now. We thought it's a good time now to really compare the two blocks, the Western bloc versus the Eastern bloc. So there's many different aspects, financial, monetary, economic, political, security. What we do is we compare them and we have a look at where the Eastern bloc is, where it challenges the West. And then we have a look at the Western bloc and is it losing its influence or not? I would let you read the report to look at our conclusion, but you'll find our insights actually quite interesting. The other thing we actually look at in that section is there was this this is quite unique. America's national debt is $34 trillion. America's yearly interest repayment on that debt has exceeded $1 trillion now. Every year, America's having to pay $1 trillion. And that now means is money that should be going to education, healthcare, infrastructure in America is now going to have to go towards paying the national debt. And what you saw at the beginning of the year, there was a new documentary called Finding the Money. It was made by an economist called Stephanie Kelton, where she looks at modern money theory. And in the documentary, which was doing the rounds at the time on social media, there's a very interesting or funny interview with Gerard Bernstein, who was President Joe Biden's economic advisor. And what happened is he struggled to explain why the US was in debt when it prints its own money. So when Stephanie Kelton asked him if we can print our own money, it obviously begs the question, why exactly are we borrowing in a currency that we print ourselves? And what you find is Bernstein, he went into a long rant where he said he couldn't explain why the US government was in debt when it prints its own money and why it has to borrow its own money when it actually prints its own money. So what we do in this section, we actually have a look at why is America in debt and why is it in debt when it prints its own money? And the findings are actually quite interesting. We go into history, how the central bank came about, the Federal Reserve, how money is printed, and why does America do what it does? And I will let you read the report to actually look at our conclusions, but I will say it's very interesting what we found actually, why America's in debt and why nobody can explain this, because it's actually a very convoluted system America has when it comes to the government debt and when it comes to money. So definitely, I'll leave it to the report because you'll find the findings we have are very interesting.
Every year, there is a deep dive section in the report. So what's this year's deep dive section?
So this year, Yusuf, we're looking at technology. You can't get away from it. That's what everybody's been talking about. So what we do is we have a look at the nature of technology, where it fits into geopolitics, what's the role it's played historically, why it's so important today. Then we do a review of the two technology giants of our time, which is America and China. And we find it very interesting that whilst America has been the tech leader since World War II, what you find is losing and it's starting to lose that number one position. China has come very, very far in a very short period. And in the next generation of technologies, America will no longer have a monopoly. America may be the leader in the technologies we have today, the internet, hypersonic missiles, or semiconductors. But what you find the next generation of technologies like quantum computing, like the next generation of missile space launch, in biochemistry, in AI, what you find in all the research in these areas, China actually leads. So what we do, Yusuf, is we have a look at the relative technology. We compare these two countries, and then we actually look at, we categorize the net, I think there's 60 technologies, which are the technologies of the future. We categorize them into about 9 or 10 categories, and we look at the research done, who leads it. And the surprising thing is China actually leads in most of these areas. And in some of these areas, China's lead is so far in terms of research, it will probably have a monopoly on these technologies when they come about. Now, we have to keep in mind researching in technology and turning it into a product and taking it from the lab and from the university dormitories to the private sector, to the market, can be quite a big leap. But the only way to measure the competition in future technology, because the technology doesn't exist yet, is who's leading the research, who's producing papers on it. So we made use of an Australian think tank that has a technology tracker, and we made quite a lot of use of the material they've published in actually looking at this. So it was very interesting. And I think maybe in 2025, might be a good idea to sit down and actually do a podcast on this and go into a lot more detail on it.
Yeah, I've got a lot more questions about 2025 for you, Adnan. But yeah, I think it will be a good idea to sit down again and do another podcast on that. Thank you for your time again, Adnan. For the audience, you can download the full report, which will be published on the 27th of December from our website. Please also keep an eye out for our 2025 forecast that will be coming out on the 1st of January. So a lot to look forward to. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.